From Islamic Finance News, the world's leading Islamic finance news provider, this is IFN Podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Assalamu alaikum and good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the last session. We saved the best for last. In this closing session, we will be dissecting sustainability-linked financing products. We will be opening the floor to Q&A during the last 10 minutes of our session. We also have question cards on your tables if you want to write down your questions, and you can pass that to our team, and they'll pass it to us. We'll try to answer those. So today we heard a lot of discussions on the various aspects of Islamic sustainable finance, perhaps particularly with linked financing products. Regulations and guidelines are very important, right? So to start off this panel, maybe I can get everyone's take on whether a uniform set of guidelines and standards should be adopted for Sharia-based sustainable capital raising instruments. So maybe we can start with Dr. Ayaz.
All right. Assalamu alaikum and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Marlena. My answer is yes. Right. So in recent times, I've had the privilege of working on the government of Indonesia's green sukuk issuance and the government of Malaysia's sustainable sukuk issuance. Now, when we offer an instrument that requires compliance to both Sharia and sustainability standards, we need to ensure that we meet both requirements without exception. Now, both the government of Indonesia's green sukuk issuance multiple times and the government of Malaysia's sustainable sukuk issuance were resounding successes. So the existing guidelines and standards are fit for purpose. However, I believe that we could go one step further, that is to have a standard that perhaps combines both sustainability and Sharia requirements. Now, such a standard would be stricter than the standalone Sharia and sustainability standards. But as I just mentioned, the sustainability issuances that we have in the market already meet this hypothetical combined standards. I believe that this would help to further embed the convergence of the principles of Islamic finance and sustainability. Thank you.
Interesting. Bashir?
Thank you. You know, you're right, absolutely. From our own experience in Dubai market, what we find that there are a number of standards that's already been issued. You've got, you know, by Climate Bond Initiative, CBI, you've got by ICMA. So as an international, you know, regional hub for capital raising, we find that some of the standards that have been issued by these, you know, standards are quite agnostic. Because they only focus on certain procedures and certain processes like use of proceeds, you know, external review, reporting obligations, which are, as you know, it's not religious, you know, there's no religious sensitivity around those things. So for the market that we have, maybe it's true, maybe from some of the different, it may differ from a market to a market, but in the market that kind of we are seeing, where as something in the region of 24 billion worth of ESG sukuk that has been raised in and from the DIFC, the issuers are quite comfortably complying with these international standards. But again, I'm saying from the perspective of my market, so you know, it's just a different perspective. Stop there.
Jeffrey?
Yep, thank you. So my short answer is yes also. From a second party opinion provider perspective, when we meet with issuers and clients across the globe, many are confused. It's still a very rough road for everybody to go. There are numerous principles, starting from ICMA to CBI to many taxonomies in different regions, but a uniform approach for Sharia-based or SRI-linked products will be a very good starting point to really reflect what's needed for investors and issuers in the region as well as in this particular product group. But at the same time, what's really important is that, you know, we need to have the interoperability with other international standards or taxonomies, and I think the real good example is the common ground taxonomy in China. So it's a bridge between Chinese taxonomy and the European taxonomy. I think it's a good example. Something like that, where we can actually hit the interoperability, I think it will definitely have more use cases.
I think on my end, I'll probably add an echo with Jeffrey that uniformity is something that's going to be useful for the market and the respective players. But there is also, you know, the uniformity allows certain jurisdictions or certain domestic markets to have a reference point. And that compatibility towards these global standards will actually help to close the gap, perhaps even allow for easier access for cross-border investors and issuers. So that uniformity with perhaps a bit of a customization depending on the respective jurisdiction is something that we should continue to work towards, all parties. And the collaboration and the ongoing discussions between, you know, like the ASEAN taxonomy versus the EU taxonomy versus the China taxonomy, I think that ongoing discussion and the various forums and platforms that are out there is something that, you know, should be more actively supported. Thanks.
Okay, for me, I think the answer also yes, whereby the standard guideline must be there. Because based on the experience before, for example, like on the liquidity management itself, before that, you know, when we launching the commodity murabaha site, right, there is a lot of, you know, standard, not many standardization in terms of the agreement itself. But now, you know, when they're coming out with standardization on that, everybody is, you know, much more faster and then solve of the issue of the taking time of the signing the agreement. I think the benefit of the what we call that the standardization itself, it will be helping that, you know, in terms of sustainability, right? It will be helping some of the thing prevent from the greenwashing itself. The other thing probably, you know, it will create the you know, ensure that the sustainability capital raising product truly the designed with the objective. I think I stop there. Thank you.
I think what's interesting is basically all of the panelists have more or less said, yes, we do need a uniform set of guidelines. But throughout our panel discussions today, we have heard some sentiments that maybe there is an oversaturation of regulations in this space. What are your thoughts on that? Maybe Bashir?
Oversaturation, yeah, I mean, yes. That's a major concern because even like when we look at, say, when we look at the documentation, the prospectus is coming from sovereign issuers, whether it be Indonesia or, you know, for example, Islamic Development Bank, who's issuing Wakaf, or any other issuer, but they tend to make a reference to a particular standard. And I think most of them are pointing towards, you know, ICMA. What we have done is in order to not to replicate and come up with our own set of requirements, what we did was we said, you know, because given the fact that it's an international hub, we said the issuers are, you know, are free to choose whatever standards they want, as long as those standards are, you know, that's something that we could recognize. And so what we have set out is those principles is based on ICMA without having to, you know, go down the route of coming up with our own issue. But having said that, it is, again, you know, UAE as a whole, you know, I'm speaking now out of my jurisdiction, the IRC, but as UAE as a whole, there are initiatives that's going on there where we are looking at possibly coming out with our own taxonomy because we just have to, in order to cater for the, you know, onshore market. So yes, there is the issue of oversaturation, but at the moment we are tackling it by giving it in a form of voluntary guidelines and trying to avoid imposing one standard over the other.
So this new regulation coming out of the UAE, will this be voluntary or mandatory?
That remains to be seen because it will be, it is probably, is going, It's going to be issued alongside the COP28. So we don't know whether they're going to make it mandatory or not, but I'm sure there'll be a phased approach for adoption of the local standards.
Absolutely. So starting in the neighborhood, Jeffrey, how can ESG criteria be effectively integrated alongside Islamic finance principles to support sustainable projects and capital raising in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, so I think if I step back and really think about how sustainable or thematic financing market has evolved, I think we started with a question, and this is Moody's approach as well towards ESG credentials, is so we all acknowledge by now the fact that, you know, corporate sovereigns, we are facing E and S and G risks, and it will accelerate as we try to meet the 1.5 temperature alignment. So all the corporates will have to identify which E and S, I'll put G aside, E and S risk profiles will be hitting my financial profile. Because if you are facing a transition risk, which means you have to invest more in new technologies for automobile company, it could be EV technology. For many of them, renewables to reduce their own scope emissions, so on and so forth. And that means, you know, more capex is required, that will mean more leverage, that will have negative implications on your cash flow. So as a rating agency who provides second party opinions, but our core role is to also look at how E and S and G is affecting the credit rate profile. So we started off by answering that question to the investors. And then second pillar is, so how can corporates tap into the thematic market and help them with that increasing leverage and capex needs? So sustainable finance comes in at this point. And if you look at the sustainable finance, and we provide second party opinion on thematic debt, whether that's a green bond, social bond, or KPI linked instruments, that investors started with looking at, so what is green? And that comes in with the ICMA principles to have a framework. You need to follow 1, 2, 3, 4 pillars. To get eligibility criteria on your user proceeds, you need to follow certain taxonomies. That's whether European taxonomy or ASEAN taxonomy. But investors started to look into how green. I think Mushtaq in the morning session talked about the grading of how green is it? How social is it? I think investors are wanting, demanding to hear that at this point in time. And that's why some of the ESG credentials, when we are looking into thematic market, and it's also trying to avoid greenwashing, is the projects relevant? If you're financing a solar panel rooftops, is it really relevant to your decarbonization pathway? Are you financing the relevant projects? And second of all, what kind of projects are you financing? What kind of technology you're using? Are you using EV batteries, or are you using hybrid systems, or CCS technologies for gas stations, steel industries, so on and so forth? So we will be looking at the relevance as well as how much contribution it will actually bring to the table. So those are the two components that we look at when we assess the second party opinion. And we also look at ESG risk management. So you have a very good will that you're investing a lot in projects, but if you're not managing your ENS risk, for example, if you're building a new airport by reclaiming land, then obviously there will be biodiversity issue, aqua diversity issue, and if it's not managed, there is that inherent negative externalities that will have negative implications in the long run. So we also look at ENS risk management, whether the the issuer has actually, you know, policies in place, which will mitigate some of the inherent risks that, you know, the projects will bring. And for the last component of what we look at is coherence. For examples of issuers that has quite sizable investments in fossil fuel related industries, or weapon manufacturing, alcoholic beverages, it could be anything that's going against the UN SDGs. But we're not saying that, you know, because you're investing in fossil fuel, you can't raise debt in the thematic market, because we think that's not fair, because the UOP instruments were introduced to help everybody to transit. But what we are saying is, because there is a reputational risk for the issuers themselves as well, it's very important to transparently communicate with investors and lenders and other market participants. So we are saying we have done the coherence assessment, and there is a risk of investing in fossil fuels, but, you know, we take an analytical one notch down from the final outcome, but it doesn't necessarily, you can still come out at a higher end of our rating scale. So it has been designed that way so that the issuers in those fields can still access, but at the same time mitigate some of the risks of greenwashing, which is, I think, really critical when we are developing uniform guidelines for Sharia-based or SRI-linked kind of instruments.
Dr. Ayaz, from a banking perspective?
Yeah. So like Jeffrey, I too would like to go back in time a little bit. So as recent as 10 years ago, when we were speaking to potential Sukuk issuers to issue Sukuk instead of conventional bonds, we would share with them that there was specific demand for Sharia-compliant instruments, that they could open themselves up to a new investor base and thereby diversifying their investor base. And as the Islamic capital market ecosystem developed and became more sophisticated, it became more compelling for these issuers to consider issuing Sukuk instead of conventional bonds. Now, if you looked at in Malaysia, the Sukuk issuers were given incentives. Chief among them was tax deduction on issuance costs. So it came to a point where it made absolute sense to issue Sukuk over conventional bonds. Now, the question being posed today is, how can we efficiently integrate ESG criteria alongside Islamic finance principles? Leveraging on what has been said this morning in this forum, my view is, if an issuer is able to ensure that the use of proceeds will be used for sustainable purposes, then I believe it's worth the taking the extra steps to formulate a sustainability framework and to commit to the reporting and governance requirements of such an issuance. The sustainability ecosystem is developing at an exponential pace. And for these issuers, the question is not if, but when they will commit to this sustainability journey. And making their issuances and their instruments in sustainability format would be a fantastic way to start.
Absolutely. So alongside Southeast Asia, the GCC is also a key Islamic finance market. So Bashir, with COP28 around the corner, what specific measures and strategies is the DFSA planning to implement in order to align the goals and objectives of COP28?
Yeah, the COP28 is like, it's a global coalition. And, the UAE has been given the privilege to host it. It is at most important that there are commitments to be delivered from our rising out of COP28. So as a UAE being, if I can just start with the national level, so we need to fit in at the DFSA, which is one of the regulatory authority in the UAE. So we need to fit into the wider agenda of the country. So the country, of course, is committed to go to net zero by 2050. So that would probably put UAE as one of the earlier Middle East countries to achieve that net zero target. Now, again, it was based on certain planning, climate change transition planning, because as you know, it's a UAE is a nation which is primarily driven by a fossil fuel economy. So for it to actually, so you need to consider a few things, not just how to actually control the green house emissions, but also at the same time ensuring that the economy is sustainable. And so therefore they had to, it's a delicate balance, and therefore and also they need to strike some sort of a diversification plan that will work in the UAE. So knowing that that's the overall framework that UAE is heading, so where the DFSA fits in is obviously all both public and finance and public finance as well, private finance, they all face same competition, and they are financial, financing activity. Financials are actually a solution to climate change. So where the DFSA coming in is really to see whether how much of the mandate that we have in order to catalyze, how much we can catalyze it, how much we can amplify, and also the financial tools. The policy making tools. The regulatory tools that we have in order to steer our regulated firms, banks, the banks and insurance companies and funds and all that, as well as our capital market towards achieving this goal. I can go out. Maybe I can give you some specific examples later. But yeah, that's at the moment we are working together and trying to align ourselves with the UAE agenda.
Absolutely, so very much a top-down approach then. That's right. So top-down is important, but collaborating is also crucial. So Dr. Zabidi, how can collaboration between governments, financial institutions, and international organizations be fostered to promote sustainable finance initiatives in Southeast Asia?
Okay, I think the collaboration between the government and financial institution and also the international organization is very crucial at the moment for me. Something that collaboration can be done in such a way whereby, by establishing the platform for a dialogue, in this case, whereby you can create a platform for regular dialogue and knowledge. Sharing of the sustainable finance and also the best way is to exchange the ideas and also the best practices of the sustainable finance. The other thing that I can share here, whereby you can share in terms of the sharing the expertise and also resources, whereby the collaboration by sharing this expertise, research and also resources related to sustainability finance. And for example, like you provide the technical assistance to among the players itself. The other thing is that we can do something like coordinate the policy effort to align to the national and also international sustainability goals, right? The last one that I can think of is whereby engaging the shareholder, because the shareholder is very important in terms of the sustainability finance, whereby including you have to include something like civil society and also the academia. I think this shareholder is very important role to make sure the successful of this sustainability finance. It cannot be financial institution. It can be the stakeholder must be from the government. It can be from financial institution and also the other stakeholders such as. I mentioned just now is civil society and also the academia itself. That's my thought on that. Thank you.
Absolutely. So building on that, Millie, as a banker yourself, what do you think should be the role of financial institutions in popularizing sustainable sukuk?
Well, as a banker, as banks, we are the intermediaries. And we're also sitting on a lot of panels, even with ICMA and with the various local regulators. So we have a role to play in terms of bridging between what investors' demands are, their challenges, and at the same time, from a regulatory or international standards perspective, what are the developments there? So Sustainable financing, it's currently, it's ever evolving. What is allowed maybe 12 months before, it's probably, we can't say for sure it's still allowed today without heightened reputational risk. And that's, I would not say it's anyone's fault. It's just how evolution is. And to a certain extent, I think that's how Islamic finance evolved from a, you know, low awareness level to gaining more acceptance along the way, getting challenged. And that's where, as an intermediary, I think we have to play that role to bridge between the different players. In terms of the other roles, from the issuer perspective as well, I think usually these are corporations. They may not be well-versed with the developments and the challenges. And that's where we come in with structuring ideas, for example. And, like, you know, alluding to what Jeffrey said, there are certain structures, for example, we're all familiar with plain use of proceeds. And then we are familiar with the concept of KPI link or sustainability link. But, you know, for example, at HSBC, we have done what we call a double ESG, you know, structure, where an issuer, typically in a more challenging sector, for example, in energy or thermal producer, where just a plain use of proceeds issuance may get challenged in terms of how far your corporate level commitments are being advanced. So at the same time with committing to certain use, green use of proceeds, the issuer is advised to also commit to certain KPIs that are perhaps emission reduction link. So structuring is one area where I think banks play the role. And that communication between the various parties, from issuer all the way to regulators to investors.
Dr. Ayaz?
Building on from what Millie has shared, financial institutions have many conversations with our clients, and the nature of these conversations over the past 3 years have evolved. So 3 years ago, the conversation was, what is sustainability for a business? 2 years ago, the conversation was, how can we incorporate sustainability into a business? So last year, the conversation was governance of sustainability and avoiding greenwashing. Today, the conversation is, sustainability is the future of business. Next year, the conversation would have moved along significantly along the value chain. So the trajectory of these conversations have been exponential, and I guess financial institutions play a big role in popularizing sustainability sukuk by virtue of these conversations that we have with our clients and bringing them up to speed of the latest developments in this area.
I think what Dr. Ayaz and Millie said about sustainability-linked products is interesting when we think of it from a credibility perspective. Would you say that KPI-linked products lend the issuer a degree of credibility that vanilla sustainable issuances don't?
So in the first, perhaps 2 or 3 years ago, we did find that a number of issuers were unable to tap on these thematic issuances. It was difficult to ensure that all the proceeds would be channeled towards green projects or sustainability projects. But yes, these KPI-related issuances gives them, I guess two benefits come out of it. More issuers are able to tap into it, and it does allow them to build their credibility in the space.
Jeffrey, from a ratings agency perspective, do you have a take on this?
Yeah, I think we speak to intermediaries every day. We speak to issuers, investors every day. And if I go back to where I left in my first kind of answers, the issuers started to look at how green it is, and then they moved on. So they are further scrutinizing the market, and that's where these KPI-linked products comes in. And I think, as Millie mentioned, that, you know, we're seeing a lot of dual frameworks these days. So EOP on top of the EOP, they have KPI-linked kind of structures. And that is because investors and lenders are now asking for, okay, your projects, your assets are green, and it's very green, let's say. But are you green? They started to ask about the corporate level greenness. And it all goes back to the key foundational question, is the issuer aligned to 1.5 or near 1.5 or 2.0 or way above 2.0? So many investors started to say, despite the UOP is very, very green, I'm not going to invest if the corporate issuer level is not green enough. And the KPI comes in. So, but it matters what kind of KPIs you're choosing. Because, I mean, obviously, I think ICMA has done a fantastic job coming up with the registry, which helps issuers and intermediaries to really look at what's the relevant KPIs. But if you look at the market convention as of today, you know, 60-70% of the commonly used KPIs are GHG emission, which is quite relevant because if a hamburger company comes to me and says, I'm gonna have a KPI to on the recycling of my packaging, so I'm gonna make my packagings more greener. Yes, of course it's relevant and it's good, but it's a very nice thing to do. But what are you going to do with your scope 3? All the cows that you're sourcing and all the emissions that they're producing, if you don't tackle that part, the large portion of your total GHG emissions are not delivered. And what we're struggling at the moment is what clients are struggling at the moment, especially in this region, is that scope 3 is really difficult to calculate, especially the bank issuers and sovereign issuers are very active in the region, but it's almost impossible to calculate your finance portfolio emission. So it's quite difficult, but there are also very creative kind of structures coming up. We all admit, okay, scope 3, it's for the future for now. So I'm going to very proactively reduce scope 1 and 2. But within scope 3, wherever there is something that it's under my control that I can reduce it, I'll start to put that into a secondary KPI to supplement the core KPI of scope 1 and 2. So I think how you structure these KPIs, definitely, I think, you know, As my fellow panelists have said, this opens up a great opportunity for hard-to-abate sectors and many others to tap into the thematic bond market where UOP has clear limitations because there's not many of, especially in this region, there are not many of corporations have sufficient assets to finance their green financing. Many of us are hard-to-abate sector. We are the manufacturing hub for the globe. So we are inevitably, you know, we're exposed to high-emitting sectors. So, and the KPIs that's most relevant is GHG emission, and scope 3 is most of our emissions. So I think we need to start from somewhere. It's a great opportunity. The SLB, the KPI market, at least on the cross-border market, is very, very small still in Asia. But I think it opens up a big opportunity, everybody, if we start to use it really wisely.
Absolutely. So we've kind of talked about the conducive landscape for developing sustainability-linked products. But in order for us to have longevity, governance is extremely important, right? So how can we ensure the adherence of these KPIs post-issuance? And what are some of the tools available for this?
So definitely second-party opinion plays a role within that because just like our credit ratings for our rating agency, what we are trying to provide here is a transparency tool between investors, lenders, and issuers, as well as regulators, that they can come in, they can trustfully and transparently read the credit profile. Second party opinions acts similarly as the credit rating. So we're trying to be the bridge between the issuers and investors to transparently and smoothly communicate their plans, strategy, what kind of financing that they're trying to do. So that's how SPOs can be used. When I go and see my clients, many of them say, oh, can I get a lower funding cost if we get an SPO? Probably the answer is no. The green premiums are very, very narrow, and especially times like this from last year when the capital markets are really underperforming, I mean, that premium tends to get narrower. But SPO2 is a great communication tool. And if you can use it pre-issuance and post-issuance, it's going to help you in a different ways. So pre-issuance, definitely you're more looking into the relevance of the projects, magnitude of the projects, as well as, you know, your coherence strategy, as well as your ESG risk management strategy. So those are kind of communications that you can do with your investors and lenders at pre-issuance stage. Post-issuance, not very common in this region. It's very common in Europe, but it's not common in Asia. I think some of the Korean and Japanese issuers started to do post-issuance more commonly. But for the post-issuance kind of process, there's two different things. One is verification and one is SPO. So verification is your firms coming in, looking into the numbers, actual allocations, and verifying and doing the due diligence whether the money was spent as it's supposed to be. Second party opinion is an opinion. It's not a verification, not an assurance. It's an opinion based on that verification report. So it's quite similar to the audited financials versus credit ratings. So we're trying to provide an opinion on the verified numbers. And by using the second party opinion as a monitoring tool, you can continue that communication with investors and lenders that you have been doing before your issuance. So it's like a continuation, ongoing monitored process, which I think helps to really bring up the transparency, especially for the hard-to-abate sectors.
Absolutely. So building on the governance discussion, we're also seeing a lot of discussions on the role of tech. So Dr. Zabidi, is there a role for technology in improving transparency and efficiency in Islamic capital markets for sustainable finance?
Okay, I think in terms of that, I think technology play a significant role for me in improving transparency and also the efficiency of sustainability finance, right? For example, that data management itself, right? It enable to the collection, storage, and also analysis of vast amount of data related to sustainability factor, for example, ESG data itself. And the other thing in terms of digital platform itself, whereby, you know, that connect investor, issuer, and also other stakeholder in sustainability finance ecosystem. And in fact, blockchain itself play a major role here, whereby, you know, ensuring the integrity of the ESG data and also enabling efficient tracking of impact of investment in these ESG. The other thing is that probably in terms of the fintech solution itself, whereby fintech innovation, for example, like a robo advisor, can make a suite sustainability finance more accessible to a wide range of investors. And lastly, probably in terms of the reporting and also disclosure, is very important in ESG agenda, whereby simplifying the reporting and also disclosure itself of sustainability information enhance the transparency for the investor itself. I think that's my thoughts on that, why innovation is very important on the technology side. Thank you.
It's interesting. So, Bashir, what approach is the DFSA taking with this? So how is the DFSA integrating ESG principles into its regulatory framework? And how will the authority encourage financial institutions to adopt sustainable practices and report their ESG performances in the post-COP28 era?
Yeah, this is a continuing process. I mean, COP28 is an event. So a lot of this, some of the KPIs that we have rolled out, we would like to achieve before the COP28 because it gives you that kind of, it puts you in the spot and gives you the publicity of what we are doing. But the thing is, this is an ongoing process. Speaking from Bonds and Sukuk, ESG Sukuk perspective, we saw ESG Sukuk coming into space in Dubai in 2018, and also then it followed by a corporate issuer. And so we needed to react because we are seeing something new. We have to put something outlined. So that's the point we discussed with ICMA, and we came out with some sort of a brief guideline. Now, post that, then the real journey towards ESG started in 2021. When we had to actually we formed a working group with all other regulators in the UAE, Ministry of Finance included, also the onshore regulator, and we formed a group. It's called a Sustainability Working Group. Under the Sustainability Working Group, they are working on a number of themes, like taxonomy, as I mentioned earlier, and also some disclosure for companies. So now we are taking those branches, those themes, and then we are trying to roll out. So in terms of integrating the ESG, so one of the things that DFSA currently looking at is really to see if we could get our firms, our financial services providers, to actually discuss a little bit more the risks around the material risks around ESG and its compliance. And at the same time, we are trying to internally build a robust supervisory tool in order we can actually monitor some of this risks that we are talking about. And that is on the financial banking and on the financial firm side. And on the issuer side, we have also went back to and looked at our guidelines and started giving more specific guidelines around what ESG is, updated, aligned with international best practices, and what is like all this, practitioners have been talking about, all the KPI-driven type of sustainability, linked type of products, as well as we also came out with what we think with the increased level of activity on ESG, we see increased level of greenwashing as well. And so we needed to actually see how we needed to talk about greenwashing. It was inevitable. So we are talking about what we think is greenwashing is going to be like and a company should or should do to avoid the risk of greenwashing. So that's currently we're working on right now. At the same time, in order to make sure that we are aligned with the rest of the world, we are working with Basel, with ISCO, IAM, NGSF, and many different international setup, and also bilaterally with regulators here in Skits Community. We do have meetings as well as MES Singapore. So I'll stop.
Yeah, Bashir, I just want to build a little on the DFSA. So you mentioned firms earlier. Does it have a different approach for firms operating within the DIFC? And how are these financial institutions being supported in their ESG journey?
I think what we are trying to do is we have to recognize that these firms are, most of them are subsidiaries or branches, and therefore they will be subjected to their own national regulations. We take cognizance of the fact, and however, at the same time, that is why what we're trying to do, as much as like we do for any corporate issuers, capital raising, we're trying to strike a minimum harmonization. In other words, you come to a level where you know that rest of the firms, regardless whether they are DFC incorporated companies, which is subjected to the whole host of regulation or of a subsidiary or a branch, where may not necessarily cannot enforce. We want to make sure that we strike a minimum required default. So it is still a work in progress. And one of the things that is going to we should be able to come out roll out will be the disclosure obligation for all these reporting entities. For the firms, and as I said, it's, the fine details are out there, and as soon it'll be out before COP28. But again, the substance of this is that we are looking at, making sure that we have a minimum harmonization.
So that's exciting. Looking forward to reading the standards. We've been talking about this from the perspective of regulators as well as financial institutions. So on the flip side, Millie, what options do the deployment of sustainability-linked financing structures offer issuers, and are they properly understood?
I think we spoke a bit about, you know, issuers just now, and just I would just like to add, with regards to issuers, to have that awareness on how the Islamic sustainable financing products will be able to, can be structured to meet their own milestones, right? Their own business model and their transition roadmap. Now, one key point I think I'd like to make, and that's also related to why the deployment of sustainability-linked products have been not as fast as some parties would like to, given that it's supposedly more general use, for general corporate use, but you commit to KPIs. I think one key preliminary step would be a top-down approach. The corporate or the group of companies must first have established their own transition roadmap, their own commitments and targets to climate change and, you know, this ESG journey. Now, it needs to be a top-down approach. With those corporate level commitments, then comes your milestones and your targets that you wish to achieve. With that, you then overlay those into your, you know, sustainable financing product. And that's how it should work. So different markets and even different segments, and an SME may not be as advanced as, say, a large conglomerate or an MNC in terms of setting up this ESG framework from a corporate level. So these have to be understood from a top-down perspective. And I mean, as an intermediary, obviously, we want to close deals, but I think that's a bit of a bottom-up approach. It's quite key to, you know, have to journey along with our clients as they transition. And there are certain sectors where a change in business model might be required, right? I mean, if Jeffrey is saying, you know, what do you do with your scope 3, all the cows, you know, emission, you know, but I'm a burger company, right? So if I'm to significantly reduce that, I have to change my business model. That has got implications. That's got credit implication as well. You know, transition risk, right, basically. So I think from an issuer perspective, you need to first set your goals top down. Then you need to be able to partner with, you know, your friendly banker and, you know, your SPOs, and make sure that, you know, whatever instrument that you're using to finance sustainable activities meet your business model. And then, you know, that's where we then get perhaps the best distribution and investor engagement. You know, that's how it progresses. Yeah.
Jeffrey?
Yeah, as a friendly SPO provider, I 100% echo what Millie has spoken here. I think somehow there was a big boom of thematic markets, but I think the starting point was not really well anchored in many cases, because even the use of proceed type of bonds should be part of the journey of that decarbonization plan. But I think there was a big kind of a fandom, just let's try to issue, I want to be the first somebody from some regions or some sectors. And I think many of them are using as a promotional tool, which is nothing wrong. I think it's a good thing to do. But at the back of the mind, the investors and lenders are evolving. They're raising their bars every day, and they're moving towards, do you have a plan? And if you don't have a plan but tries to access the thematic market, at one point you're not going to start asking about like green premiums, but you not be able to access the market if you don't have a plan, if we continue this journey at this pace. So it's really important from a top-down level that, you know, these are my ESG risk, these are my materiality metrics for my company. I'm going to mitigate some of the risk by using green financing or transition SLBs or transition bonds. I mean, again, not very defined product, but whether that's green bond, transition bond, SLB, KPI-linked kind of instruments, it will have to somewhere sit into that materiality metrics and your decarbonization pathway. And social comes in very naturally because if you're aggressively transiting, and you know, if you some of the social matters are negatively impacted, you know, of course, you know, you want to do social as you go, you know, following the just transition concept. So I think having that mindset and drawing that blueprint it's very important. But I think at this point in time, I think there's a lot of study, that homework that we have to do, all of us, yeah.
Those are interesting takes, particularly what Millie said about kind of alluding to the infrastructure that needs to be in place to really tap sustainability issuances. So organizations having ESG frameworks and ESG roadmaps, I think you're kind of alluding to sustainability in a sense being disruptive. Like, for example, businesses having to change their business model. And you also, I guess, implied incentives driving this sector. How do you think these two things tie into each other? Do you think when ESG disrupts a particular business, should there be a kickback for that or something like that?
I mean, this CAPEX is all what we're trying to raise, right, in order to be able to finance our transition, do our part for climate change. If you don't change, you know, you're putting your company at risk. And that's why, you know, that's where all that CAPEX and that financing is required. But in order to get access to that, that's where there needs to be an understanding, both from the issuer side in terms of what's eligible, right? You don't want to just label something and then be accused 6 months later, 12 months later by activists. You also need to have an understanding of, I mean, take for example, if you're talking about a gas project, obviously that's cleaner than coal, for sure, but that's still transitional and that's not, you know, green per se. So understanding all these nuances and keeping up with the standards and the demands, which, as Jeffrey said, the bars are being raised every day. So that's actually going to be challenging for all parties involved. Yeah, we do need to all work together and make sure that we understand the standards and the challenges, which will continue to evolve, actually. And on that note, I do think that Islamic financing is actually one of a good way to finance sustainable activities and projects, because it's in itself Islamic financing and Islamic products already have a filter to remove activities that do harm, right? And that is very much aligned to investors who want to go into investments that have an impact-based, outcome-based kind of investment. So they go hand in hand. Actually, I see it as a very good platform to push Islamic products as well.
So you talked about understanding, and I think we've been dancing around the issue of literacy quite a lot throughout our panel. Literacy has been an issue in Islamic finance, and it's also an issue in sustainable finance. So maybe Islamic sustainable finance has the compound issue here. So Dr. Zabidi, do you think we need to enhance investor awareness and education regarding Islamic sustainable finance products and their benefits?
Okay, I think before that, probably I agree with what Melly mentioned, whereby, you know, the thing is coming from top to down, which is, you know, very important in any equation, especially when you wanted to do the ESG agenda. The top level is not really from the management side, but actually from the board members, right? We must have a lot of board members who are understand about the sustainability finance. If they, you cannot buy in this, I mean, the board member, I'm sure it cannot flow through to the to management and also at the working level. So that's part. The other thing is that I think your question on the to create awareness and education regarding the Islamic sustainability finance is very important. For me, the answer is yes. Whereby not many investors, as you know, understanding about the kind of the sustainability product. For example, like probably corporate there is, right? But in investor side, it can be coming from the SME level, it can be from individual. If this individual is not understanding about the what is the benefit of this product if they invest in, you know, and in terms of risk itself, and other than that, probably, you know, how they can contribute towards the sustainability goals, right? So one of the, I think I can think of in terms of the benefit of itself is that by promoting the transparency and also standardization in reporting also can help the investor better assess in terms of the environmental and also social impact of their investment. The other thing probably I can name by providing the accurate information and highlight the potential financial benefit of sustainability investment, we can also encourage more investors to consider incorporated sustainability to their investment strategy itself. I think my answer is yes, important to create awareness. If without awareness, I don't think this, what I call that, sustainability finance will be successful in the future. So education and each party must involve, for example, academic or NGOs or financial institution or you know, public sector and also government must come together to make sure this sustainability finance agenda is moving forward towards, for example, climate change, you know, that kind of thing will be zero carbon by 2030 or 2050, right? So this is my view on that. Thank you.
Dr. Sabine? Sorry, Dr. Ayaz.
Yes. When we first embarked on offering a green and sustainability Sukuk offerings about 5 years ago, we noticed that green and sustainability investors were not willing to invest in these papers. Now, the reason was because Sukuk was a new instrument for them and their mandate did not allow them to invest in these papers. So what followed was a period of education and awareness where these investors realized that such offerings were actually in line with their requirements, and it made in larger numbers. So in essence, and I agree with Millie here as well, she mentioned it earlier, the principles of Islamic finance are very much in line with the principles of sustainability. And if we were to enhance the awareness of investors, we would definitely see increased demand for Islamic social finance, for Islamic sustainable finance products.
Absolutely. Millie, do you have a take on this also as a banker?
I think the other awareness building point that we face trying to convince investors to go more into Sukuk, and it's that you're not necessarily giving up any returns. You're not sacrificing returns, right, when you're looking at Sukuk. So yeah, that's the additional point that I'd like to make. So it's a journey on building that awareness. And very happy to see that there's been tremendous growth in the Sukuk markets. I mean, we have now seen acceptance even for very long-term Sukuk papers, 30 years, 50 years. So that's actually a very good sign, and there's more to come.
So I have one last question before we open the floor to Q&A. Millie, you mentioned not sacrificing returns, right? But we also talked a little bit about green premium. I think Jeffrey talked about that a lot. So who is bearing this cost here if you're not sacrificing returns?
We're working harder for free to, you know, educate all parties involved. No, I mean, it's basically... when we widen the investor base, it helps both the market and definitely the issuer, you know, and with the wider investor base, that comes better price compression, you know, more cost-effective fundraising. We take it as end-to-end, that's the ultimate goal, yeah.
If I can may add, so if we're talking about direct dollar cost, I think definitely... investors are not willing to sacrifice, issuers are not willing to take that. If there's no additional funding, lowering of funding costs, you know, why am I doing all this additional burden of work? I think what's important is that, you know, some of the clients that we have worked in the past few months has been saying that when I used to go out to the market with a very little information using thematic issuances, I've been getting 4 pages, 5 pages of questions from investors with a very detailed second-party opinion, having all the potential like answers for greenwashing concerns and etc. They were able to really minimize that burden of answering all those questions. So it's a fact that it's now embedded in the investment committee process that, you know, you have to answer certain questions, and that list is getting, it's going to get longer, not shorter. And I think there is a lot of indirect financial benefit by, it's just like an investor's relations of a company. It's more of a continuation of your IR, that, you know, you're sharing your decarbonization pathway. And therefore, you're alluding more diverse, responsible investors. And it may not have a direct dollar saving, but you know, you're having a lot of indirect benefits of having more transparency in terms of these topics.
Absolutely. So it's still worth your while then, essentially.
We believe.
Yeah, and the incentive schemes help, so that awareness has to continue. And hopefully with more players coming in, I mean, maybe there'll be more competition on SPO providers, we will probably, or intermediaries, will probably see more competitive fees. That it helps, you know, to broaden and open up and have more players. Yeah.
Definitely. So let's see if we have any questions from the floor. Sorry, I may completely fumble this. We are about 3 years away from 2030, yet it seems that the global community isn't doing enough and aren't urgent enough. I'm guessing we're not hitting the targets we said we were going to hit. So how can we... the attendees of this in this room play agent practical, play urgent practical proactive roles to expedite transition finance? And this question is addressed to everyone. So essentially, we are way behind our targets. What do we do now? Does anyone want to take a crack at that?
Well, just to start things off, I think, yes, we are behind the curve, I guess. We all are. And that's why I think there are many conferences like this. There's a lot of government support. The grant schemes in many of Asian countries now, we have grant schemes, which is really helping. And it's going through the banking system to really go down all the way down to the SME levels. You have heard about it throughout the conference today. I think different pockets of financial system is working really hard. Of course, it's like a building an IKEA bed frame, right? I always get it wrong. And then I have to maybe sometimes step back and then rethink about how what was the right way. And I think we're making that trial and error. But if you think about 2 years before, none of this was in discussion. Nobody was talking about what's my decarbonization plan. Only the very top advanced companies will, you know, discuss about it. But now, like, every single meeting client I go into, I was in Mongolia last month, I was in Cambodia a few weeks back, every single parts of Asia I go, meet sovereigns, regulators, banks, corporates, they all talk about, you know, how I want to do my decarbonization strategy. So that's a lot of change from 2 years before. So I think we have made a great progression. And I think we are at the S-curve that is going to get our pace of adoption of and getting nearing to the 1.5, maybe not 1.5, near 1.5. We're going to get faster and faster and faster. Nobody talked about solar and wind will be this popular. If you follow that WEO forecast, you know, past 10 years, every year it got adjusted up. And now we're following that S-curve. So I'm very positive that, you know, we're having this discussion today.
Yep. So building on from what Jeffrey had said, from where I sit in my bank 3 years ago, not many of us knew what sustainability was. But today, each one of us has to be a banker that's able to speak about sustainability. 3 years ago, when we spoke to our clients, they were not interested to listen on sustainability. Today, those same clients have got departments that are incorporating sustainability into their business, and they're coming to us asking us how you can help us on this journey. So you're right, we are behind schedule, behind time, but things are moving at an exponential rate. And as Jeffrey mentioned, things are going to be happening even faster after this.
So at least it's hopeful then, right?
Also, if I can add, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, we're having all these COP meetings is to see how, you know, those who have fallen back and how we can now actually accelerate towards, you know, achieving those those initiatives. So it will be an opportunity to see, you know, what other actions they are putting in place for all those, you know, plans that's not, you know, hasn't taken off. So it's an event to also to watch.
Definitely.
Just very quickly, I think it's quite clear we have moved. We have moved forward. We are slow, but I don't know whether we're going to get a 1.5 or close. But the answer is clear. We can't stop. We can't slow down. We have to progress. And one thing to add is I would say in this part of the world, the progress might not be as fast as in the developed nations. And we've got different circumstances like energy security concerns, right? And we are more developing compared to the developed countries. So in this part of the world, I would say we play our part by challenging what policies and standards that are out there so that it becomes more of a just transition for our part of the world as well. So continue to challenge and move forward.
For me, like a small player, right, important that the top-down level, you know, everybody are responsible for that, whereby we at the company level, we have the first one who's starting in terms of the sustainability agenda. We have the, we call it SRA program, Sustainability and Responsibility Program, whereby the mandate we got from the board level, whereby they wanted each of the unit are responsible in terms of net zero by 2030. Internally, we have the sustainability head, whereby to monitor each of the unit to make sure that they are more carbon printing, something like that. So responsible is not really from regulator side, from banking side, but internally we must have that, you know, going towards to the ESG agenda. It is not one stakeholder responsibility is everybody. So that's the part that, you know, we can move faster. If not, if one stakeholder, you know, did not aware about this, you know, about ESG, then, you know, it won't be successful in the future. That's my thought, yeah.
Sure. So we have one more question from the floor. How does the industry combat the negative comments from the likes of Citigroup, BlackRock, and debunking ESG? Does anyone want to take a crack at it? It wasn't addressed to any specific panelist. There's no way we can combat negative comments, it seems.
I suppose what is meant is, there will continue to be negative comments. There will be criticism from various parties. To me, I think that's actually quite healthy. It encourages dialogue, engagement. It makes sure that all parties think deeper. It creates an opportunity to discuss, right? And it's a journey, so there are bound to be criticisms. So we do have to engage and deal with it and, you know, move on.
Yeah, just to add to what Millie has said, something that we ought to expect. It was the same journey that it was the same experience in Islamic finance as well. When we first embarked on Islamic finance, there were lots of comments, and some were saying that it was Sharia washing, so on and so forth. This feedback is useful for us to ensure that how we carry out the business is more robust. And until today, we still get feedback on the way we do things over here in Malaysia. So yes, I agree with Millie. It is something to be expected, and we should welcome it and do better where we can.
So essentially, it's a product of the free market and competition, right? That's what keeps us in place. So to close off our session, maybe I can get everyone's take on what are some of the better benchmarks of sustainability products? This is from the floor. I know we said, Jeffrey, you kind of alluded to that maybe greenhouse gas emissions is not antiquated, but it's a... maybe we should move away from that moving forward when we look at scope 3. What are your thoughts on this?
Just in terms of product, first, I think definitely as the need from investors, lenders, and regulators change, I think the product suites will also develop. I think no matter whether that's a voluntary or mandatory requirements from the regulator, or investors demanding for a new tool. Like, for example, I think many of investors are moving towards whether a corporate is temperature aligned. I mean, where are they on the temperature alignment side? And I think we, at Moody's, we are also developing a new product that, you know, it's on the request for comment is something called net zero assessment. So it's basically a temperature alignment tool where the issuer is, are they at 1.5 aligned or 2.0? I think there is various institutions like SBTI or IEA that provides a similar kind of language, but as a third party opinion provider, we are trying to supplement our current SPOs as well as ESG and credit ratings because investors are demanding for that. And that's why I think the product, I think there's no like a perfect product at the moment. I think the market is evolving. I'm not sure SPOs will be here 5 years later. I mean, I might lose my job, but I think the market will evolve, and therefore we're going to have more new products coming in.
Marina, just a quick one. I mentioned this at the beginning. I think the question was on a benchmark. I think a standard that merges both Sharia and sustainability would be something to think about. If not globally, perhaps in Malaysia, because we are already quite good at it. We are already doing quite well on that metrics. And yeah, I would suggest that would be something that we could consider.
Absolutely. So, sorry, I said the closing off earlier, but we just got one more question specifically for Jeffrey. You mentioned SPOs. This is from Anthony from HSBC. He says, as an SPO provider, what are the major challenges or concerns that you face or hear during your conversations with the various corporates?
I think the biggest challenge is that many corporates are fearful of coming to the market, especially the international market, where they feel that, you know, we need to follow all the European taxonomies and we're not ready for that, so on and so forth. And I think people are very fearful of getting accused by greenwashing. I mean, everybody's talking about greenwashing these days. So I think that's the most big challenge, because my issue is they're not willing to come to the market. But the reality is that, you know, even if you get a lower scaling on the second party opinions, there are plenty of cases where they were successfully able to tap the market without any financial penalties. So they were able to have that successful kind of issuance with, you know, lower rating scales. And the reality here is that, you know, I think all investors, they have different bars, of course. They have different bars. So some have more stricter high bars and some have more flexible ones. But as long as you're able to transparently communicate your limitations, and this is the best I can do at this point in time, but I have a clear pathway. And this is my strategy to get there in 20 years' time or 30 years' time, depending on what your national policy is. So I think having that transparency going into the market, if you have a transparency, there's no issue, actually. But that doesn't work well. You know, I don't want to... When we were first rolling out credit ratings in Asia, nobody wanted sub-investment grade. Everybody wanted triple B plus above. But now the market has changed. We all know that high yields can actually tap the market here as well. So I think it's quite natural, but that's the biggest challenge that we're facing as a second-party opinion provider.
Absolutely. So I guess today we touched on the need for uniform regulations. We talked about the importance of literacy and the role that financial institutions play, in addition to obviously the top-down approach from regulators. And we also touched on the evolving landscape in terms of the types of KPIs that issuers should be looking at, as well as pricing for sustainability-linked products. Please give my panelists a round of applause for their insights on this. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more discussions on the Islamic finance industry, log on to www.islamicfinancenews.com. You can also listen to IFN Podcast on your favorite platforms, including iTunes and Spotify.